Today on Against the Grain, was the emergence of capitalism a preordained affair? Was it natural and inevitable that capitalism developed in England and spread to the rest of the world, as conventional accounts would have it? Or was capitalism's emergence contingent, arising out of social conflict in the countryside? Marxist scholars Christopher Isett and Stephen Miller will join me to explore what the history of agriculture can teach us about class society in general and capitalism in particular. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. What can the history of agriculture tell us about the world we live in, with its extreme inequalities of wealth and power around the globe, and the way it came to be? Quite a lot, argued two radical scholars, as long as we recognize that the history of agriculture, like the history of economic change, is not the product of either the predictable unfolding of preordained events or dictated simply by the constraints of nature. 10 years in the making, their book, The Social History of Agriculture, examines how the social struggles of peasants, slaves, farmers, and elites shaped class society, looking at, among other examples, ancient China, New World slavery, and capitalism's emergence in England and Japan, as well as agriculture in the Soviet Union and Cuba. Its authors are Stephen Miller, Associate Professor of History at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and Christopher Isett, who's Associate Professor of History at the University of Minnesota. And they join me today by phone. Steve, let me start with a central question. Looking at the history of agriculture since class society was first established, was it inevitable that we'd end up with capitalism?
Absolutely not. The main goal for people actually doing the farming, since the earliest times of farming, 6,000 B.C. was, or 5,000 B.C. or so, was to provide for local needs of the people actually doing the farming. Now, they were always constrained by elites who mostly used force to take from them. State force or their own local military power to take from the actual tillers of the soil. But the goal of farming was never to make money. That only emerged because of fortuitous circumstances which moved brought about by the conflict between elites who sought to take the surplus from the farmers and the farmers' efforts to fend for themselves, to protect their own livelihood and their own subsistence farming and communities. So the whole point of our book is that there was no natural or evolutionary tendency towards capitalist farming for money rather than for local use.
Well, that then raises the question, what defines capitalism? How different is it than all the other forms of class society that preceded it? Chris?
Steve and I draw heavily, we should point out, on the work of Robert Brenner in this regard. And in short, our argument is that capitalism is the upshot of a specific set of relationships between working people, agriculturalists, you know, for the most part in our book, and between them and their communities and between elites, of course, and then, of course, this broader relationship between workers and elites. And it's a very special kind of relationship which renders everybody essentially dependent upon the marketplace. And what we mean by that is that the means by which individuals obtain the things they need to sort of get by in the world, their labor, land, machines. They have to go through the market to obtain these inputs. And in going through the market to obtain these inputs, they are then compelled to produce commodities. And from that flows a whole set of circumstances and important sort of consequences. Once compelled to produce commodities, they are subject to the forces of the market that require them to be competitive, forces them to specialize, to cut costs, and to successively, regularly, and sort of over very, very rapid periods of time, add and replace the capital, these tools and machines and other aspects of sort of the productive process, to drive down their costs. And the upshot of that is rising labor productivity. So it's this rendering of producers and non-producers really dependent upon the marketplace. That's the sort of the basis of the appearance of capitalism for us.
What is the role of specialization under capitalism?
I mean, specialization is essentially it's the ways in which organizers of production maximize the returns on their labor, right? Rather than engaging in sort of every single activity that's required to keep yourself alive, you focus on those areas of production, those lines of production in which you are best equipped to profit, to maximize the value of your time. And one of our points to this is that for much of the history of agriculture, this is not the way in which people have chosen to actually produce. They produce an entire range of items that they require to survive, many of which they may not be particularly suited to do, but they have to do it because it's an input, it's a food source, whatever it happens to be, that they need to continue to reproduce themselves. Specialization is honing in really on one line of production. And in agriculture, this means, you know, specializing in grains, certain kinds of grains, specializing in livestock, certain kinds of livestock. That's what we mean by specialization. It's a very risky venture, specialization. And one of the reasons peasants choose not to do so is because of the risks entailed. Market-dependent people have no choice in this regard. They have to produce a commodity to survive, and therefore they will specialize despite the risks. And they will, of course, seek ways to ameliorate those risks, one of those, of course, being searching for ways to cut their costs and to improve the productivity of their labor.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that up until the fairly recent past, that is, with the advent of capitalism, that society and agriculture with it was organized in a very different way, that capitalism really represents a rupture, that producing for the market really has fundamentally changed how the process of producing in agriculture takes place, and that we should think of it, although obviously capitalism is another form of class society, and class society was not invented with capitalism, that it really represents a sea change in the way that the economy and agriculture in particular has been organized.
Yes, I mean, certainly that's how we would see it. The sort of what the modern world in which we live today, especially in the sort of advanced capitalist countries, the evolution, the formation of this economy really hinged upon the appearance of capitalist property relations. We argue, alongside with Bob Brenner, you know, in the late 15th, early 16th centuries, that what it brings about is a transformation in the way farming is done that drives the agricultural revolution. And the agricultural revolution is what lays the basis for the appearance and deepening of manufacturing, or I shouldn't say the appearance of manufacturing, but the deepening of manufacturing and the Industrial Revolution. And of course, today, you know, agriculture has been reduced in the United States and much of Western Europe and other parts of the world, capitalist countries, to a sort of a slim part of the entire economy, and the industrial side has sort of grown much larger. But that would not be possible without the agricultural revolution, and that itself, of course, we argue in the book, is the upshot, the result of this transformation in property relations in England in the countryside.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking today with the co-authors of the book, The Social History of Agriculture, that's published by Roman and Littlefield. That was the voice of Christopher Isett, Associate Professor of History at the University of Minnesota. I'm also joined by Steve Miller, who teaches history at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. So we will talk a lot more in this hour about agriculture under capitalism itself, but let's talk about how pre-capitalist agrarian societies were organized, starting with the first class societies when settled agriculture was established in Mesopotamia and ancient Roman and Han China. What, Steve, preceded these societies and how did they come into being?
If one were to say that there's a natural form of human existence, it would be hunting and gathering, because for around 190,000 years, that's what humans did. They lived fairly well in hunter and gathering. The anthropologists and ethnographers have found, in comparison to the first settled agriculturalists, because hunter and gatherers, they had a varied diet of wild grains and other foods that grow naturally, and of course meat from hunting. Whereas agriculturalists, the first agriculturalists, people who depended on farming, they had to deal with the risks of crop failures and possible famine, and also living closer together of diseases. Being more sedentary, they had to worry about diseases. So people, hunter and gatherers, it seems, were more healthy. So the question is, why did they start to depend on farming? A mechanistic theory, which I don't ascribe to, is that simply the population grew after the end of the last ice age. There were more area for animals to roam free, and it became difficult for humans to hunt them down, and so they had to start farming. But one of the points of our book is that major historical changes are usually contingent and based on things people do, choices they make, and their desire to change the world in which they live and to live better. And so it seems more likely to me that people, they must have had some desire to change and become settled agriculturalists. They must have wanted a different sort of interface, a relationship to nature, because before they could even start farming, they would have to think about how the food would be distributed, how they would, how in communities they would have to grow it, and things of this sort. And all this must have involved human thought and forethought about what a new society would look like, how the food would be distributed, who would do the distributing, and so on and so forth. It was a massive change about 10,000 years ago when people decided to settle on farming, changed their whole relationship to nature and led to class society and probably made them more unhealthy and led them to live, not to live so long as they had lived before.
How, once settled class society was established, how did elites take possession of surpluses? How did elites become elites in these societies?
The first class society that we go over, that they seem to have emerged, settled agriculturalist societies and civilizations in six or seven different places around the earth. But the first one we go over were the ancient Mesopotamians, the Sumerians. And it was a stunning development, the fact that these folks lived in an urban society for the first time in history. Mesopotamian societies could reach 30 or 60,000 people. So it seems that the basis of class rule, the people who appropriated power, were the people who were the ones who became the guardians of the place where the grain was stored, because the grain was the source of life, and it was centered in the dozen or so cities of Mesopotamia. And the people who were the guardians of the grain surplus developed religious ceremonies to celebrate the community, they would be the heads of the political networks and control these Mesopotamian cities. And they represented the values of a society which probably saw themselves as having accomplished something relative to other peoples in the vast region of the Middle East at that time, that they had developed an urban society. And these people in charge of the buildings in the center of these cities were the ones who guarded the surplus.
Whether looking at peasant societies, I mean, going from antiquity to the societies that preceded the emergence of capitalism. So whether it was peasant societies, feudalism, slavery, obviously they vary widely as their structure, the process of production in agriculture. But can generalizations be made about how productive they were? If we're talking about struggles over the surplus that's produced, how much surplus was produced in this long period of time up until the emergence of capitalism? Can generalizations be made?
Yes, I think so. I think that one could make generalizations, and one of which is that since the actual people doing the tilling of the soil farmed for their own good, for their own subsistence, taking care of the people, of households and communities in the countryside was the principal goal of the farming. That what was left for possible development of the towns was limited by that very fact. Now elites could apply pressure to try to redistribute the surplus to the towns, but there were limits to how much could be taken, and if too much pressure was applied to the peasants, then they might rebel or free, and there would be disruptions, and there would be even less available for the rest of the economy. And in periods where there are population growth, because peasant societies tend to generally to have population growth because they don't have developed social welfare systems like modern societies do. And so the form of social security the peasants generally had was to make sure that they had offspring that could see to the older generation when they were reached a point in life when they could no longer work. And for this to happen, women generally had to be pregnant often during their childbearing years. And this tendency to assure that the next generation would exist had a tendency to lead to population growth. And with population growth, there was even in rural areas, there was even less surplus available for the rest of the economy. So there were definitely finite limits. As you pointed out, great diversity over world history in peasant communities and in class states where people didn't farm for money but farm for local use. But in general, there was the surplus was limited for the rest of the economy, preventing industrialization or development.
Well, speaking about limits, when we talk about agriculture, obviously we need to talk about nature. That's a central aspect of agriculture. What was the role of nature in shaping how these societies, these pre-capitalist agrarian-based societies, look like? Can it be overstated in looking at why some places prospered and others were poor?
I would say it definitely could be overstated. Of course, people have developed ingenious ways to get the most out of their natural environment, but I think one of the points of our book is that people have shaped the natural environment far more than they have been shaped by it. And as soon as settled agriculture appeared, nature would never look the same. Sheep, for example, didn't bear excess wool. It was the earliest agriculturals who did selective breeding. Same with chickens and surplus eggs and things of this sort. They were always selectively bred, and nature was changed. And when people started to cut down forests to farm, they exposed the earth to rain, which led to erosion and changed the natural topography across the world. And, of course, one of our major conclusions is that the differential outcomes and development across the planet are not the result of any natural endowments that nature has provided for people in different parts of the world. People weren't vowed to development or non-development. It's rather the social relations which has led to in which people live, the class relations in which they live, which leads to repetitive behavior on the part of the population, behavior which people normally aren't even conscious of, which lead to different kinds of economies and different kinds of technologies and different sources of developments and the way people then go about changing the natural environment. One example is in Great Britain, the areas with coal in the north and west of England had been the granary of the country during the feudal period. But once the agricultural revolution had got going, it was found that with the latest techniques of convertible husbandry, it was found that in the south of the country, these were the soils which previously had just been areas for sheep grazing, were the most amenable to the new husbandry, convertible husbandry, and they started to produce grain at the lowest cost. And the northern and western regions then found themselves uncompetitive. They were dependent on the market already. So since they couldn't compete in grains, they had to turn to other activities, one of which was specialized animal husbandry and dairying. But this doesn't require so much labor, so they had to engage in manufacturing as well. And then they had to actually look for, in competition with one another, for new sources of power, and that led to the precocious use of coal in those regions. But coal didn't destine England to down a certain path of development.
I'm speaking with the authors of The Social History of Agriculture. That was Stephen Miller. I'm also joined by Christopher Isett. So let's talk about the emergence of capitalism in England and in Japan. Let's start with England in the 15th century and the point that Steve just made about the crucial role of political social struggles in looking at social change in history, in agriculture, not just seeing things being dependent on population growth or the circumstances of the environment. What role did social struggles play in the birth of capitalism in England?
We're both students of Robert Brenner, and we took this argument from Brenner, and it's actually been reiterated very recently in a great book by Spencer Dimmock. But let me just state that what happened was that in the feudal period, during the feudalism in Europe, serfs, the peasants of Europe, they farmed first and foremost, as we've been stating, for the subsistence, for the good of the community. But they always had to fight against, to fend off the claims of the lordly classes, of the nobles, who sought to use force. They were knights who sought to use force to claim the peasants' subsistence. And there were constant social struggles. What happened in England, it seems, in the 1300s and 1400s, was that there, the lords, unlike on the European continent, were better organized, and through their ability to bring force to bear on the peasantry, they weren't able to force to maintain serfdom across Europe, Western Europe and England. During the 1200s and 1300s, the peasants became free. They gained the right to move about, choose their profession, and leave the places where they lived if they so chose. They were no longer forced to stay on the manor. But what happened in England is that, unlike on the European continent, is that the lords in England, they were able to change the conditions of peasant tenures. If the peasants, when the peasants passed on their plots of land, or when they took up a plot, the lords were able to vary the entry fines, the fees that the traditional feudal fees that the peasants needed to pay to use the lands. And over time, these fees, since lords could vary these fees, they could obtain what the market would bear. And therefore, to obtain the use of the lands, the population of England, the ones who actually did the farming, had to compete to obtain the right to use the lands within the lord's demesnes, within the area over which the lord had jurisdiction. And so they had to sell on the, their produce on the market to meet the terms of the conditions for the use of the lands that the lords could set, had fought for the right to set. And since they had to compete with one another, they had to start to introduce all sorts of innovations to obtain market share, to be able to obtain the right to use land. Whereas this didn't happen across the continent, the channel. In France, the traditional seigneurial payment to the Lord of the Saints was invariable. It didn't change all the way up until it was when abolished in the French Revolution, and the lords couldn't vary the incidence. The peasants had established their right to pass on their land with no change in the dues they would owe to the lords through their struggles in the 1200s and 1300s, whereas they weren't able to impose this right of inheritance in England, and instead had to compete to use the land and therefore begin to innovate. To introduce new ways and better ways of farming so that they could make the money to pay for the what had become competitive leases to the lords.
And then, Chris Isett, what happened in Japan leading to the emergence of capitalism there? Obviously clearly not exported from England, but what were the circumstances that led to its emergence 2 centuries later?
Yes. The argument we pick up here is that in the 17th century in Japan, with the consolidation of a sort of a new political regime that brought to an end a prolonged period of warfare between daimyo, lords, local lords, and sort of the subsequent peace. The ways in which that peace was put together, the ways in which elites were pacified by the centralizing shogunate power, and the manner in which the samurai warrior class was brought under control, we argue in the book that this set up a new kinds of relationships within the village, not everywhere in Japan, but in certain parts of Japan. And this was the sort of starting point for this, the emergence of a very precocious, highly commercialized farming system, which is very evident by the middle of the 19th century. The argument we put together is drawn from the work of Grace Kwan and others that what essentially happens in the village is that you get something quite similar to what happened in England. I mean, just to make it, I suppose, easier to understand. The village sort of grandees who in the Warring States period had managed to acquire large sort of tracts of land had also, over this period of chaos, incorporated the households of poor community members under their authority, and so they had a sort of a captured labor force and control over land, and they used this captured labor force more or less, you know, to extract surplus and to reproduce themselves. Some of these village grandees were themselves warrior members of the warrior samurai class, or caste, really. Others weren't. But in pacifying the village, what the shogunate was able to do was to remove the warrior class from the village. So warriors, samurai, were expelled from the village, required to leave. Those who left, stayed behind, could do so, but had to abandon their arms. But also at the same time, the shogunate was very interested in building up a small holding peasantry, one could say. That is, freeing these dependent households from the village grandees and setting them up on small plots of land, which would then be directly and more easily taxed by the state. So the formerly dependent households are sort of taken out and sort of freed, one could say. But what also happens at the same time is that the state really fails to prevent the village grandees and others from who emerge in the subsequent period from extending or reasserting control over land. That is, extending the land, their control over village land, and bringing more of it in. And what you end up getting is a few villagers who control and dominate most of the land, and large numbers of villagers who have to enter into leasehold tenant contracts with their with the local village grandees, or hire out as wage laborers. And we argue that this this establishment of a laboring class, market dependent laboring class, and sort of commercial tenant class creates the conditions, establishes the conditions that require more and more production in the village be directed to commodities and exchange, and this subjugates production in the village, in the countryside, to the compulsion of the marketplace, cost cutting, and so forth. And so you begin to get slow, but nonetheless visible improvements in land productivity for sure, and most probably labor productivity as well. It's a little bit more contentious, but there seems to be improvements in labor productivity. At the same time, villagers who fail to make it as agriculturalists turn to handicrafts and manufacturing. And you begin to get also the side-by-side emergence of manufacturing, rural manufacturing. By the middle of the 19th century, you have in Japan some villages which are dominated by farming, some that are dominated by manufacturing. And you have a very, very commercial system in which new tools are being applied, new kinds of fertilizers are being applied, and much of the activity of the day-to-day work is sort of guided towards producing for the market by cutting costs and, you know, improving your market position. And we argue that this, although the book just sort of ends rather quickly at that point, we would argue that this is what lays the groundwork for the rapidity and success of Japan's industrialization under the Meiji system. That the Meiji Restoration, which begins in 1868 and brings Japan into sort of the modern international state system, it introduces new educational systems, new conscript armies, a new constitution based on European legal systems, the modernization of Japan. It has been argued that this is a top-down affair, that in a sense there were sort of elites who created this from the top down. What we argue is that this highly commercialized rural system, agricultural system, lays the basis for that rapid and successful transformation in the late 19th and early 20th century. That without it, without the transformations in the countryside in the Tokugawa period, Japan would certainly look very different in the 20th century. Whether or not it made its way to capitalism, that's a question we can't answer. But it would have had to have found a very, very different route and probably a much more difficult and complicated one than it ended up pursuing.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the two authors of The Social History of Agriculture. It's published by Roman and Littlefield. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Christopher Isett is Associate Professor of History at the University of Minnesota, and Stephen Miller is Associate Professor of History at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. So, Chris, in talking about the modern period and talking about agriculture in the broadly modern period, one instance of the way agriculture was organized, I think, can be somewhat confusing in all of this, which is, what is the history as capitalism was emerging in England and then in Northern Europe, later in Japan? What is the connection of that emergence with the colonies, and especially with plantation agriculture in the New World? How should we see it, and what was its relationship to capitalism?
Yes, a very vexed question. I mean, our position is that the New World slave system, and Steve can talk more to that of the southern states of the United States, but the New World, the slavery in the New World, especially in the West Indies and the southern states of the United States, grew up certainly alongside capitalism. There's no doubt about it. I mean, just simply looking at the sort of time trajectory of these things, this capitalism is fully in place in England by the time West Indies are settled. The cult plantations are set up in the West Indies, and certainly the accumulation of wealth by merchants and others, you know, on the backs of English agricultural revolution, and that facilitates the adventures of the plantation owners in the New World. But we don't think of slavery as a system of capitalism. It operates in a very, very different way in the New World than capitalism does. It's not to say that the commodities from the slave plantations don't end up in circulation within capitalist economies. It doesn't mean that the monies that are created and generated through the trading systems within England, but also in England's colonies, doesn't flow back into the plantation system. They are clearly not hermetically sealed in any way. But slavery New World slavery is a very, very different kind of system. And we have basically on two points. The first is that plantation slavery is, of course, well, I'll get to the two points in a moment, but it is, of course, a highly commercialized, highly commodified system, right? This is production of crops for sale. And if managed profitably, it is a very profitable system, right? If managed well, it's a profitable system for the plantation owners. But the reliance on slave labor has certain important repercussions for the trajectory of this system, its long-term viability. But also the ways in which improvements are introduced, for example. And on this, there's sort of two important aspects about the plantation that we want to highlight. The first is that the slave is not a wage laborer. The slave is therefore not under the same kinds of compulsions as the wage laborer is. The slave cannot be fired. The slave is not dependent upon the development of his own personal skills to acquire jobs in a wage market. And this means that the slave requires far greater, far more intense observation and oversight than the wage labor typically does. The other, perhaps equally important point, is that the slave is, in the minds of the plantation owner and in the sort of their also in the form in which the plantation is organized, is equivalent to a fixed capital. The slave is not paid, he or she is not paid a wage. The slave is, in a sense, treated much like a machine. And what this means is that, like a machine, first of all, you only acquire as much machinery as you can or as you need for your operations. So there's a sort of, there's a limit to how much you want to apply. But once you've purchased the machine, you want to use it to its maximum extent. And so the tendency in slavery is for the intensification of work rather than the application of capital of tools to work. So the innovation in slave systems is actually very, very slow. And often over long, and for long periods of time, the kinds of machines and tools that slaves use are very, very simple and hardly change. In the sugar manufacturing, in the sugar plantations, essentially, it's the hoe, you know, a long pole with an iron hook at the end, and the machete. This is the extent of the application of tools to work. There's, of course, the mill itself, but the millstones itself also quite remarkably undergo very little transformation over time. But what is the great innovation in the plantation is there is, suited to the sort of nature of the slave is oversight. For example, ganging of slaves, the use of, this is a sort of form of organization in which slaves are grouped together in tens or twenties, assigned an overseer, and put to work doing the same task. This ganging of slaves is one of the most important innovations, and yet is not a labor-reducing innovation. It's a labor-intensifying innovation. It's one that gets as much work out of the slave as possible.
Well, what about the relationship between capitalist ways of organizing agricultural production and what became the colonies in Asia and Africa, especially in the late 19th century? Whole regions of the world were carved up amongst European imperial powers. What sort of agriculture was part of those systems, and how did it relate to capitalism? And how should we see their legacy today in terms of thinking about empire, North and South, the global North and the global South? Steve?
The way in which the colonies that were established at the during the 1800s, particularly at the end of the 1800s, and then into the 20th century, the form of agriculture that was established in these colonies in Africa and Asia really depended upon a struggle again. How much the Europeans could take from the people, and how the people could resist. And this negotiation, this struggle, led to the form of agriculture that came into existence. Now, the key problem once France, Germany, Portugal, Belgium, Italy, England, especially England, Great Britain, they ran into when they took these colonies was that the people of Africa and Asia lived in communities and sought to farm for their own subsistence, to farm to feed themselves. And so to get these people to do anything useful, monetarily useful for investors in Great Britain or in France or in other countries was a challenge. So one example is that in the German Togoland in West Africa, like many colonial powers, this was the case for the Belgians and also for the Portuguese in Mozambique. They thought that, well, if we could get these peasants to grow cotton, this would be very useful for investors in industry back in Europe. But the problem is that Africans, they had no reason to grow cotton, and Germany made all sorts of efforts, inducements to get the people of the Togoland to grow cotton. They built railroads so that the price, so that the cotton growers could get obtain a market in Europe. They introduced special seeds that would grow well, and they introduced marketing agencies so that the peasants of the Togoland could grow cotton very well. They showed them how to grow cotton, and so that they could make a profit from it. But they didn't obtain any of the results they wanted. The people of the Togoland had no interest in farming for money. They continued to farm for the safety and the security and the good of their communities, and the German colonizers never obtained optimal results. Now, other colonists, they behaved in they acted in much more draconian, forceful ways. And the notorious example, which probably a lot of listeners know about, but surprisingly not enough people in the world know about, was what happened in the Belgian Congo under the King Leopold II. At the end of the 1800s, he realized that given the industrialization in Europe, that the rubber, which grew in rubber trees in this region, would be lucrative for trading companies and for industrialists, for bicycle tires, for the lining for electrical cables, and for other usages. But again, the people of Central Africa had no reason to go to climb into trees and spend all day in trees, tapping trees for their rubber. So rather than resign himself, King Leopold II and the trading companies who worked with him, they introduced force. They used military force to oblige people to go into the forests and collect rubber. And the people weren't allowed to return to their villages and farm for their subsistence unless they met their rubber quotas. And the result was extreme violence against the people of the Congo. Terrorism was used. Exemplary massacres were used to intimidate the rest of the population. There were often the repression was farmed out to a military force under Leopold II, a local military force. But there were so many rebellions against the colonial overlords that the colonists, the Belgians, and the king, they wanted to make sure that any ammunition they provided for the local military forces that they had contracted out to help get the rubber delivered, that none of this would fall into the wrong hands, be used against them. So any bullet that was used, they wanted to see a severed hand from the local population. Local military forces wanted to use the bullets for hunting and things of that sort. So sometimes they severed the hands of live people so they could use bullets for other purposes. So it was an extremely violent operation to get the rubber. And I forgot the actual statistics, but it probably reduced a population of tens of millions by a third or half or maybe even more. And this was the worst example of the new imperialism and the efforts to force the local population to engage in agricultural pursuits for the benefits of the colonizers. But historians have focused on this atrocious example from the Belgian Congo, but it was repeated across the region in Portuguese Angola, German Cameroon, the French Congo, with a similar loss of millions of lives. Maybe not as spectacularly violent and draconian as the Belgians, but still the forcing people to farm rubber for the European overlords involved extreme violence and a massive amount of loss of life. As far as the consequences, I can give one good example of some of the consequences from this. In the Portuguese Mozambique in East Africa, the Portuguese, again, the Germans in Togoland, they wanted the local inhabitants of Mozambique to farm cotton for trading companies and industrialists back in Portugal. But of course, people preferred to farm their local subsistence goods, what was useful to them. So the Portuguese, they mandated during the 20th century what each the size of the field that each of the peasants of the of Mozambique would have to farm for exports, and they were paid less than what was to be obtained on the world market. So they had to farm it at below market prices, and they were coerced into doing so. The the Portuguese authorities would use whips, which they'd go around and whip peasants who didn't have their fields, craft their fields according to the specifications of the colonial masters. The land wasn't meant for cotton, and cotton takes lots of nutrients out of the land. It's a very demanding crop, and the ecological consequences for independent Mozambique have been very challenging. How to farm the land productively since that period. So much land was forced into cotton by the colonial masters.
Well, Steve, lastly, what is the significance of these histories? There are obviously very different histories of how agriculture was shaped, the emergence of capitalism in certain regions, the imposition of certain relationships around the world, and then also the local histories, these histories of social struggle, of political struggle. What do they illuminate for us, taking the long view as you all have done in this book, in thinking about why certain parts of the world are the way they are, why some regions are wealthier, relatively speaking, some regions are poorer, especially in terms of thinking about the relationship between the global north and the global south?
The forcible imposition of these agricultural regimes, Central Africa with the Belgian Congo and Portuguese and Mozambique, but these were repeated in other regions. And without going into the details, it's obvious that over decades, if people are forced to farm not the crops of their choice, but for the benefit of the colonial masters, that this will have long-term developmental consequences. But in terms of the lessons we might take from this, that capitalism and development were not innate or natural for some parts of the globe and not for others. One of the important points that we make is that, and I'm not sure I did this when I talked about the emergence of capitalism in England, was that it was an unintended consequence. The lords, they were attempting to continue to impose themselves in the 1200s and the 1300s and the 1400s in feudal ways. They were seeking to force the peasants back on the land so they could collect dues from them, but they couldn't necessarily do what they want. As all dominant classes have found throughout history, people resist, and so the development of capitalism was an unintended consequence because they were able to impose their control over the land through their ability to vary the entry fines for the use of the lands, but they weren't able to continue to insurf the population and force them to be on the manor. And it was this free population of laborers, but ones who didn't own land because the lords could charge for its use, which led to capitalism. So it was an unintended consequence. There was nothing natural about it in England. In fact, this runs contrary, to Adam Smith's story of the emergence of capitalism. He reflects at one point in the Wealth of Nations on how the system, which he describes, he actually describes it very well in much the same way we would, capitalism, but how it came about. He thinks that it came about somehow naturally from the people in feudal Europe and England. When some merchants and traders arrived on the manor and showed the lords trinkets and baubles, they thought, wow, this is great. We need some of this stuff. So they dismissed all their knights, the people that they had relied upon to use force to take from the peasants, and instead decided to use their land more productively, that somehow capitalism was innate within these people, and once it had been unlocked by these merchants who showed them the values of trade and what could be gained from it, that they completely changed their behavior. And what we show is that people don't change their behavior. They struggle to reproduce themselves in the best way they can where they are. And sometimes this struggle leads to differential outcomes in different places. And so the lesson we would show is that there is no innate reason for the dominance of Europe or the United States relative to other places on the globe.
I've been speaking in this hour with the authors of The Social History of Agriculture. That was Stephen Miller. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, also joined by Christopher Isett, Associate Professor of History at the University of Minnesota. You can find a link to their book, The Social History of Agriculture, which is published by Roman and Littlefield, on our website, againstthegrain.org. Chris, Steve, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's been an honor to be on your show.
Yes, thank you.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.